silence is commanded.
I'm going to call our third case for today, 058P1487, the estate of Frank, and how is his name pronounced? R-I-L-L-E. Pardon me?
Really.
Really. Versus Physicians Insurance Company. Justice Wilcox will not be participating. Michael Van Sicklin will get 25 minutes representing Physicians Insurance. William Catt will take 22 minutes representing OSCO and ABC Insurance. Brett Eckstein will get 8 minutes representing the estate of Really. And you get 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Van Sicklin. Is that the agreement? Okay. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good afternoon. As the Court knows, I'm Mike Van Sicklin from the Madison office of Foley & Lardner. It's my pleasure this afternoon to represent the three appellants, Dr. Sheila Galbraith, the Medical College of Wisconsin, and their carrier, Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin. I'm going to track the format of the briefs and refer to them collectively as Dr. Galbraith. It's our position, Your Honors, that this case can and should be decided by application of a well-settled test that you've articulated multiple times to the particular circumstances here on the issue preclusion issue. That test calls for essentially a two-part inquiry. The first is whether or not the issue as to which preclusion is being asserted was actually litigated. The second part is if you find that it was, in fact, actually litigated, you have to then look at the five criteria bearing on the fundamental fairness test, and I'm going to address both of those. At the outset, I want to draw attention to the focus, I think, of the certification order from the Court of Appeals. There, as in all of your prior decisions, there's a discussion of the competing judicial policies that are always at issue in these issue preclusion cases. My colleagues on the left here will assert, of course, the importance of judicial efficiency and finality. I, on the side of Dr. Galbraith, assert the competing consideration or judicial policy, and that is of giving litigants like Dr. Galbraith their day in court to present evidence and have issues decided on the merits. Fortunately, this Court and the Court of Appeals in Precision has given a lot of guidance on how to weight these two competing sets of judicial policies. In Precision, quoting your decision in Crozier at page 306 of Precision, the Court notes, the most important factor to be considered is fairness to the party against whom preclusion is asserted. Here, that's Dr. Galbraith. And this fairness determination should be made on a case-by-case basis. The Court in Precision, again quoting your decision in Crozier, goes on to note that courts have departed from focusing on technical, formalistic requirements to decide this inquiry. Instead, they've gone to, quote, the final decision rests on the court's sense of justice and equities. Under the circumstances here, again, focusing, as you have, you know, directed, on fairness to the person in my client's position, Dr. Galbraith, we believe it would not be fundamentally fair to strip Dr. Galbraith of her right to pursue her contribution claim.
Counselor, before we get to that, I want to be sure, since you're stepping over step one, are you agreeing that the question was actually litigated in this case?
No, I'm not. No, I was going to come back to that, but I'd be happy to address it now.
That's kind of the first step, because if it wasn't, then we never have to worry about the rest of it, correct?
Correct. I believe there's two independent reasons for why the issue here was not actually litigated under this Court's prior precedent. First, this Court, as other courts that I've marshaled some authority in our briefs on, have held that where it appears that the trial court carved out the issue or tried to protect or preserve it, It can't be deemed to have been actually litigated. And so that calls into question this whole back and forth of correspondence about the order entered on the summary judgment motion. I'm going to come back, if time permits, to talk about that at some length. But that's the first reason why the issue here was not actually litigated, because it was reasonable for Dr. Galbraith to believe that the form of the order that she proposed, that was entered over the objection of OSCO's counsel, was intended to protect and preserve her contribution claim. The second reason why we believe the claim was not actually litigated, it was litigated only in the technical sense that the plaintiff, Rill, did not have an expert opinion to submit by the deadline in that case. And the focus of the motion for summary judgment was purely on the absence of an expert opinion report by plaintiff Rill. There was no adjudication of particular findings of fact. And that's the second reason on that.
What do you view it as, a voluntary dismissal, even though it's labeled a summary judgment?
I'm sorry.
You know, if you want to get out from summary judgment, one way of doing an actual litigation, one way of doing it is you label something in a manner that shows it's not actually litigated. Now, it's too late to go back, but you can say, it seems to me, that the essence of this summary judgment was a stipulated dismissal.
It was, and we did argue that in essence, Your Honor, in the sense that it wasn't opposed or by plaintiff Rill. And so the way this came down,
rather than get an expert witness, let's just forget it. I'll just deal with the doctor, right? He could have initially brought the suit only against the doctor.
Right. And they chose to bring in both of the defendants, and we assumed that there would be some effort by Rill to prove up their claims against OSCO, and it wasn't until the time of summary judgment that it was clear that that wasn't going to happen. And at that point, Dr. Galbraith's counsel went in and filed a brief with two supporting affidavits, which and then followed up at the hearing an oral argument and said, we would like to preserve our claim for contribution. And in the submissions that they presented to the court at that time, they noted that the basis for the contribution claim, if it went from being contingent, that is, there was a finding of liability against Dr. Galbraith, then it would no longer be contingent, and they would have the right by statute to later bring the claim, was based on the fact that the pharmacist, when she filled the prescription, did not question the fact that it appeared on its face, at least according to our expert, to require some follow-up and investigation by the pharmacist.
Mr. Van Sicklen, I have a question regarding the standard of review. It appears from your brief and from opposing counsel's brief that you both suggest this is a question of law. You cite Mrozek in your brief. I go back and I look at Mrozek and I look at Crozier, and I'm just going to look at the Mrozek decision for a moment here. In paragraph 15, whether issue preclusion is a potential limit on litigation in an individual case is a question of law, in which we give no deference to the circuit court's decision. However, whether the circuit court properly applied or refused to apply issue preclusion in an individual case is a discretionary decision. Now, here we have a circuit court refusing to apply it in this case. Is this discretionary?
Well, it's interesting. The very next sentence in that same paragraph, Justice Butler goes on and says, additionally, whether claim preclusion was correctly applied by the circuit court is a question of law.
That's claim preclusion. Right now we're arguing issue preclusion. So that's why I stuck to the first two sentences. So you've got whether or not it's potentially there is an issue of law. But as I understand Mrozek, and if I go back and I look at Crozier, and I don't have the page handy in the Crozier decision, and when I go back and I look at Crozier, it seems to suggest that these are discretionary determinations. And so I just want to make sure that I'm on the same page as the parties when we're talking about the standard of review and how we're to evaluate the arguments.
I believe it is de novo here. And the interesting intermediate decision, Your Honor, that talks a lot about the standard of review is the page KB decision that's talked about in Mrozek. And it really talks about the first inquiry. Was it actually litigated? That's a question of law. Then it looks at this fundamental fairness inquiry, and there's five factors, some of which it says under certain circumstances would be raise questions of fact that might involve discretion. Others, like the application of the first criteria about should the party in Dr. Galbraith's position have appealed, that's a question of law de novo. The fifth factor, unfairness, again, is a question of law. And so it's kind of a mixed message, and when you look at it, is complicated, I grant you. The Page KB decision talks for pages about exactly what is the standard here. I think it's important to note, though, that the trial court here did not really go through and analyze and apply the five factors in a way that would permit you to review whether discretion was properly exercised by the trial court as to any one of the five criteria. The trial judge merely said, you know, under Precision's five criteria, I find that, you know, the claim's precluded, period. And it raises the Court of Appeals decision in Phelps, which you reversed on different grounds, but there, Judge Fine in Milwaukee said, you know, anytime you're reviewing even a discretionary determination by trial court, if they don't make the findings and analysis that permit you to review the exercise, it must be reviewed de novo. And so on any of these factors, I think it's de novo here under these circumstances. Now I want to get back to why I believe it's not fundamentally fair to deprive Dr. Galbraith under the circumstances here of her contribution claim. This is not a case like Precision or respondent really talks a lot about the Gies or Giz decision. In those cases, the party in Dr. Galbraith's decision did absolutely nothing to advise the court or opposing parties of their position that they were controverting anything. They stood silent, totally. This case, we would concede if Dr. Galbraith had done absolutely nothing here at the summary judgment stage or later in the trial court proceeding, she'd be barred, just like the party in Precision or Gies. But here, Dr. Galbraith, through counsel, did a number of things. She filed the brief. She filed two affidavits. She showed the basis for the contribution claim. Counsel attended the hearing and tried to preserve it. We then had this battle of the form of the orders on summary judgment. There's no fair way to look at the record that you have, the original, and see how it was handled by the trial judge here. The correspondence and competing orders are stapled together. There's a little handwritten index at the start of it. And then you see in the same apparent handwriting that Judge Gempler used to sign the order that Dr. Galbraith proposed, striking out OSCO's proposed form of order. And the correspondence from OSCO says, Judge, don't sign Dr. Galbraith's proposed form of order because she's trying to drag back in and preserve her contribution claim. That's exactly right. And the judge signed our order, reasonably leading Dr. Galbraith to believe that there was no reason to appeal. It appeared that the position that we had advocated at the summary judgment stage had been affirmed by the judge. And in good faith, we then went forward. We got an amendment to the scheduling order that permitted us to name additional parties back in, i.e. OSCO. We went out, extended the discovery period, deposed OSCO's personnel out of state. We had no reason to do that if we weren't trying to develop a contribution claim. We went out and hired an expert. Expert developed a report showing the basis for pursuing a contribution claim. All of that was done in good faith reliance that we had preserved and protected this right.
I think viewing this as a kind of rule of the case, that trial court in effect has given you this right and that it's not fair to take it away?
I think in part, Your Honor, that it's all the case law that you've articulated talks about looking at what's fair to the party in my client's position under the specific circumstances of the case. And it is a fact-specific inquiry. And I'm saying that it was reasonable for Dr. Galbraith to believe that her counsel was doing a good job preserving and protecting her claim. It appeared that the trial judge had, in fact, accepted that. If the trial judge, I think it's important, maybe by way of answer, to look at the summary judgment statute that governs this process. When you look at section 80208 sub 4, this is what happened here. It says under sub 4, should it appear from the affidavits of a party opposing the motion, that's, again, Dr. Galbraith put in two affidavits through counsel, that that party cannot, for reasons stated, present by affidavit facts essential to justify the party's opposition at that stage, the trial court has a couple options. It can refuse to grant summary judgment, it can defer it and let the parties go out and take additional discovery, or it goes on and says, or may make such other order as is just. That's exactly what happened here under our perception of what happened in the trial court. The judge entered an order that appeared to preserve our position, and we relied upon it in good faith and went forward. It's not a precision or a one of these cases where we did nothing.
Didn't the judge's order just basically indicate that he wasn't really going to decide any issues that could or could not be brought and that would have to be dealt with down the road?
You could read it that way, but I think in a vacuum that would be maybe a fair reading. But I think when you look in the context here of what was going on, the order form that OSCO proposed said we're dismissing, it sought the dismissal of OSCO on the merits with prejudice from the case. Our proposed form of order submitted did not have dismissed from the case. It said the claim of the plaintiff, Willie, against OSCO is dismissed with prejudice. And then it went on and said that we're preserving and protecting Dr. Galbraith's right to pursue other, you know, statutorily permitted claims, which in the context of what had been argued in a brief, in two affidavits, an oral argument, in the context of the correspondence which the two sets of lawyers had just sent Judge Gempler, where OSCO's lawyers said, don't sign their order, Judge, because it's preserving this contribution claim, then he signs it, we wouldn't have the right to appeal it. So I think in that context, it informs what that language was intended by my predecessor trial counsel, you know, wanted to do here. Now, I think the second criteria that's worth talking about under the five, one is should we have appealed the order that we submitted thinking it protected us? Well, that can't have happened. The second criteria is the nature of the claim that was dismissed, that is, Willie's claim against OSCO, analytically different than the contribution claim? And the parties fight that out in the briefs a little bit, and I think it's kind of an esoteric legal issue, but I submit that it is different, that if you look at the cases we cite at page 30 of my opening brief, we talk about contribution under Wisconsin law is analytically different than the direct claim. And the precision case didn't involve contribution, by the way, or a cross claim. That involved direct claims against co-defendants. And the only effect of the issue preclusion there affected the one defendant's claim vis-a-vis the plaintiff, not vis-a-vis another co-defendant.
Counselor, in both a direct claim and a claim for contribution, there has to be a finding that that OSCO was a tortfeasor, right? And they have to be a tortfeasor for something to do with filling this prescription, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so in that context, what's the difference?
Well, the difference, I think, comes back to this actually litigated that you and I talked about
earlier. That's another question.
If they had taken the if we had done nothing and just sat there, as happened, by the way, with the other physician co-defendant, Dr. Michaels, we didn't oppose that, and we didn't preserve a claim for contribution against him because it didn't appear to be apt in that situation. But here, the judge, to our perception, preserved our claim and allowed us, carved it out, so it wasn't actually determined. Had it been actually determined, I agree, we'd have that problem.
Got the plaintiff here taking a dismissal against OSCO. If the court lets OSCO back in on your cross complaint, the amicus brief says, oh, this could be really terrible for the plaintiff because depending on what a jury verdict might be, the plaintiff might get a terrific jury verdict. That is, there may be a verdict that shows OSCO is 100% negligent and the plaintiff is going to recover nothing. I mean, that's what their argument is. Or depending on the percentages, then the plaintiff is going to get caught, and that's not fair, and that's not good, and that doesn't provide finality, and that's just not the way this should proceed.
That assumes, Your Honor, that it's that if it's reversed and remanded, it's remanded for trial as one consolidated action. The Court's got discretion, as we point out in our reply brief and conclusion, to structure this as a normal contribution claim. That is, you try the case, and it's only the contingency of the contribution right only arises if Dr. Galbraith is found liable. At that point, they can seek contribution
within a year of final judgment. Then you try ASCO in the contribution claim?
That would be a time you could do it, if you were concerned about the issue that you articulated from the Waddell brief.
Aren't you concerned about it, or wouldn't you be if you were a plaintiff?
Well, I'm concerned. I'm also concerned about the rights of the defendants here in this situation where, you know, the focus here on losing their contribution right, again, is on them. And it's a balancing of these competing considerations.
But here's the problem that I have with that. You know from at least the defendant knows from where she sits, Dr. Galbraith, that there's a claim against her. She knows that she's got an argument that ASCO should have interpreted this prescription differently, stopped it off. At least that's the argument that she has. She knows this going in the door. So if ASCO is now out of the case and she knows that there's a motion to dismiss them, doesn't she have, the doctor, have an interest in saying, time out, wait a minute, this affects, could ultimately affect me. Now, I understand they've got to go through me, they've got to find that I'm negligent too, but if there's going to be any finding, and ASCO's out there and they've done something wrong, that could come back and haunt me. Isn't there a duty or an obligation to speak up right then and stop this at the pass?
Yes, there's a duty to speak up. I believe she did here. Now, the trial judge could have said, you know, I understand that you're trying to preserve this contribution claim. Under the circumstances of this particular case, I'm going to, under 80208 sub 4, instead of preserving your right, which is one of my options by statute, I'm going to give you leave to go out and do your discovery and fish or cut bait on that claim. And I want to try it now. But what you're doing is accelerating what historically in Wisconsin has been this contingent right to seek contribution within a year after judgment. You're accelerating it to make it a mandatory cross-claim that has to be tried by the defendant's bar as part of the initial case. And obviously, you know, Chief Justice asked me the question, isn't this kind of, you know, unfair strategically in favor of the defendants? But if it goes this other direction, but by accelerating that fight between the co-defendants up into the main action, all you're doing is having the defendants prove the plaintiff's case by pointing the fingers at each other and litigating these cross-claims as part of the main case. Now, maybe that's something the court thinks is appropriate under all the circumstances here, but the trial judge, with discretion under 80208 sub 4, handled it, at least apparently, the way that we thought made the most sense, is to preserve and protect that claim instead of accelerate it and force it at that time. If the judge, you know, here, Fiorenza.
Let me just say, Mr. Van Sicklin, suppose your client hadn't come in. He's just silent on the summary judgment motion against ASCO. What would the result in this case be?
We lose.
That's right, under precision erecting.
And Roseback, and every other case.
Right. Which say you can't just sit back, you got to appear and object. So the question in this case, it seems to me, is did your client do enough appearing and objecting?
Yes.
To come within the rule of precision erecting. That is, does precision erecting require that your client object fully and litigate it fully, whether there should be a summary judgment motion, or is it enough to put in a proviso? I mean, that's really your client said, okay, I'm not going to litigate it now, but I don't want to be precluded. So she took a middle ground. And isn't the question before us is whether we should accept that kind of middle ground? Now, there are two other points I want to make to you. One, you could argue, okay, maybe we shouldn't accept a middle ground for any number of reasons, but don't apply it in this case because how the devil did we know we wouldn't accept it? And don't accept a middle ground thereafter. Okay. What do you say?
I think actually where you ended up is where I was going to respond, is that Precision and your prior cases don't give some kind of black line test of the party in Dr. Galbraith's situation has to do exactly A, B, and C. It talks about speak up, you know, advise the court and opposing parties of your interest in pursuing the issue of the claim. Under the facts of this case, I think what she did was reasonable and good faith and zealous. She didn't just totally abdicate and do nothing. However, it may well be that the court today, when it goes back and decides this, wants to give a brighter line test for future litigants, and I understand that. And it may be under that future test what she did is close or, you know, above or below the line somewhere, but under the laws that existed at the time she made her decisions through counsel in the trial court, I believe what she did was reasonable, and her reliance on Judge Gempler's order was reasonable under all the circumstances, and it would be unfair to penalize her for any lack of clarity about what was required. If the court wants to go on and make a brighter line test that sets the boundaries a little differently, I understand. That's probably why we're here on a bypass. But it's inherently an equitable, flexible test under today's law through every one of your decisions.
Would Dr. Galbraith have needed an expert witness against OSCO to really fend off a vigorous fight here for OSCO to get out against Dr. Galbraith?
Unless there's something different about the nature of it being a contribution claim, I believe you probably would, because the pharmacist has a license. And generally the law in Wisconsin is that if you're pursuing claims of negligence against a licensed professional, whether it's a lawyer or a doctor or, I assume, a pharmacist, you need the assistance of expert testimony on the standard of care. And we, in fact, went out when we were pursuing under the amended scheduling order discovery and got an expert who was sharply critical of the pharmacist. If we had been told at the summary judgment stage that you had to do it now, we would have. But we thought that that was an inefficient use of resources. If we were to prevail on liability against really, the issue of contribution would never arise.
Yeah, but within a couple of months, you did it.
Pardon me?
Within a couple of months, you filed a cross complaint. I mean,
we very promptly got the scheduling order changed and then went right out and did the discovery. And then when there was a good faith basis on the discovery and the expert, we filed the claim. We didn't dawdle.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Catt, representing OSCO Drug et al.
May it please the Court, my name is William J. Cott of Lieben Cott, and I represent the respondent third-party defendant, OSCO and Albertsons. I'd like to start right where counsel left off when he indicated that in the Precision case, it doesn't really say you have to do A, B, and C. In fact, in a quote from the Precision case in one of the very first paragraphs, it says, we observe it to be self-evident that a summary judgment motion by its very nature alleges certain facts to be in dispute. If a litigant who is not the subject of the motion for summary judgment nonetheless has reason to dispute the facts supporting the motion, it is the litigant's duty to appear and object to the motion. If not, and summary judgment is granted, the facts underlying that judgment are binding on all other parties to the suit as a matter of issue preclusion. That is exactly what we have here. Justice Rogensack asked about, was this case actually litigated? From our standpoint, you bet it was actually litigated. A summons and complaint was filed a year and a half before our summary judgment motion by the plaintiffs against OSCO alleging what? Negligence and cause. And in order to prove negligence and cause in this kind of a case, they needed to get an expert witness. Discovery did proceed. The deposition of a scheduling order was put in place. There were dates for naming experts. A deposition was taken of Dr. Galbraith, in which the deposition, Dr. Galbraith said, it was my mistake. I wrote the wrong prescription. It was after that time, after Dr. Galbraith admitted culpability, and after the time for all the experts to name, we brought our summary judgment. We didn't get a stipulation in order for dismissal. It was not voluntary. We had to file a motion for summary judgment. The fact that they couldn't come up with anything to oppose it shouldn't inure against us saying, well, you know, it was just a technicality. We filed a motion for summary judgment. They didn't have an expert. They needed an expert. Issue was joined. And just like it says in the precision erecting case, if a summary judgment motion is on the docket and you are a party, even though you are not one of the parties who has cross-claimed, if this affects you adversely, you have a duty to what? To object. Not to defer, which is really what they're talking about here. And I believe that Justice Abramson's comment about what the clear issue in this case is right on point. They're basically arguing for a new standard here, saying we don't have to object. We don't have to put in opposition. We can just defer. And the most amazing comment to me in this whole case was at the hearing before Judge Fiorenza, where the attorney representing Dr. Galbraith says, I can sit on my hands, if you will, and wait. That is exactly what the cases say you can't do.
I agree with that. But they did not, this is not on all fours with precision erecting, where the party did not come in at all, right? In this case, Galbraith did come in. They did object. They did say, look, we didn't want this held against us, but we're not at this moment going forth on this. I mean, they did get an exception.
That's not really what they said.
Okay, what did they say?
What they said was, and actually I think that's interesting because the certification from the appellate court says they objected. They specifically said, if you look at the transcript, they didn't object. In fact, they said summary judgment should be granted. And what they said was, what they were requesting, this is what they were requesting. They were saying that the order should say that it is not determinative of any claims of Galbraith and that such claims are preserved. And then at the argument in front of Judge Fiorenza, they said it should be without prejudice. So I find it incredible that they're saying we got what we wanted in the order that came from the court. The order that came from the court, true, was not the form that I had requested, but it says, it is hereby ordered that the defendant OSCO Drugs motion for summary judgment is granted. What was my motion? Negligence and cause, they can't prove it, it's gone. And the complaint of the plaintiff and all causes of action of the plaintiff against OSCO is dismissed upon the merits with prejudice. And then there is the other line that Justice Butler referred to. This order is in no way intended to affect the rights of other parties to pursue claims under appropriate statutory and or case law. I believe that Justice Butler's interpretation of that, or at least his comment about that, can't that just be seen as we're not going to deal with these other issues now? Which counsel in oral argument conceded, well, you could read it that way, but you need to put it in context. Well, let's put it in context. The context is this. The very judge that they are saying, just remember, Fiorenza is the one who heard the argument. Gempler is the one who signed the order. The very justice that they are saying carved out an exception is the judge who gave us summary judgment because he said there was no exception carved out. Gempler is the one who gave us summary judgment when they filed the third-party complaint. So how can they argue here, well, Gempler was carving out an exception? On top of that, if you look what they were requesting, which was a specific reference that their claims be preserved, and a specific reference that the order may not be determinative of Galbraith, and a specific reference of without prejudice, none of those things were given, then how in the world can you argue that in good faith they were relying on the fact that this was carved out? So they're basically arguing two things. Number one, we get a whole new exception, we can defer, and number two, Even though we didn't get what we asked for, we should, in this case, it would be unfair to take this against us.
Counselor, since there's a statute that deals with contribution, if I buy your argument, and since the only thing we're talking about here is contribution, does it affect that statute in any way?
No. The statute gives a right of contribution, which, of course, you have to show negligence and cause in this case to collect on.
Right.
But the statute in and of itself does not trump all other statutes. For example, it's still subject to a statute of limitations.
What statute are you talking about?
I believe it's 895, I don't know what the 22 or whatever that contribution statute is. It is referenced.
Well, what about 893.92 that says a contribution can be brought later?
893.92.
That's the one you're talking
that's
about?
That's the one I'm talking about.
Okay. That says you don't have to bring it in the same lawsuit. You can
True.
Bring it later.
True. But there's still an ultimate statute of limitations on it.
Yeah.
Actually, there's two statute of limitations that apply to that statute. Likewise, it does not say this trumps all other arguments such as issue preclusion. The fact of the matter is they admitted that if they hadn't appeared in the case and objected at all, they would be precluded from bringing this contribution action. So their argument that somehow the contribution statute preserves a right here, I don't think holds weight on it.
Counsel, what did your motion for summary judgment say? Was it a motion for failure to prosecute? Was it a motion for failure to name experts?
My motion for summary judgment, excuse me, is a little water, was this. We said the deadline for naming experts had passed. We said that in a medical, well, in this case, a case against a pharmacist, we cited case law that this would be outside the scope of an ordinary layperson and you would need expert testimony. Therefore, because they don't have expert testimony, we're entitled to summary judgment because they could not prove their case. And the court went through that analysis and granted us on the merits.
Now, and I was thinking about this case, I thought of the whole statute for sanctions. You know, one of the sanctions for, I assume you have here a discovery order that says you've got, in fact, I know you have named your expert by such and such a date. You didn't name your expert by such and such a date. Court has, I think it maybe is 804.12. I don't have it in front of me, but there's a statute that deals with sanctions for failure to comply with the discovery orders of the court. And against the plaintiff, you know, the court can enter a judgment against the default. I mean, it can grant a summary judgment, it can grant a default judgment or whatever. And so that's what it seems to me that we're really dealing with here. That's why I asked the word, and I just didn't quickly find it in the appendix. I found the affidavits in support of the motion and all these this litany of letters, but I didn't find the actual, I'm sure it's here, at quick reference, the motion. So it seems to me that that's really what you're talking about, and then that makes me think of, you point to the language in precision. Precision says, you know, what's the obvious thing, dummy? It says this. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the court saying to everyone. We observe it to be self-evident. Everyone can understand this. That a summary judgment motion, by its very nature, alleges certain facts to be undisputed. But, you know, that's the normal summary judgment motion. That's the normal thing where there are no genuine issues of material fact and all that sort of stuff. But judgment seems to me here to be entered really as a violation of a discovery sanction and that you didn't, a violation of a discovery order and that the court can dismiss, the court can enter default, the court can do a lot of things, and that's what the court did for failure to comply with the order to name the expert witness by a certain time.
I would respectfully disagree for this reason.
Okay.
I would say it is much more akin to me bringing a motion at the close of the plaintiff's case in a trial, or me bringing a motion at the close of all evidence at a trial where they failed to prove their case.
I think it can be probable, depending how you cast it. I mean, that's one of the fun things about the law. You can take the same thing, and it can be, depending on how you cast it. I mean, I think it could be casted as failure to comply with the scheduling order that required witnesses to be named by a certain date. They didn't name the witness. Therefore, the sanction available is out. It could be cast that way. It could be cast as you're doing it, at the close of the plaintiff's case, you say, failure to prove its case, and there's not sufficient evidence. And that's why I know how you're casting it now. How'd you cast it then?
I cast it in the sense of a summary judgment. They could not prove their case because they didn't name an expert. And I brought that kind of motion before. And the timing of my motion here is kind of indicative of what I was doing. The scheduling order required plaintiffs to name their experts by August 1. It required defendants August 1 of 03. That is about 8 months after the case was filed. There was a scheduling order required defendants to name experts by November 1 of 03. The depo of Galbraith was in between those. So as of that time, Galbraith's counsel knows that Galbraith has admitted liability. Okay? Plaintiff's expert deposition time, expert naming time has expired already in August. So as of September 12 of 03, at the time of Galbraith's deposition, Galbraith's counsel knows this. Number one, plaintiff's expert, there's going to be no expert critical of OSCO. So if I'm going to be critical of OSCO, I got to get somebody. Number two, at their client's deposition, they know, my client just admitted liability. That's in September. December 1, I filed for a summary judgment motion.
Mm-hmm. Did you name your experts according to the scheduling order? Did you name an expert?
I didn't name any experts because nobody named any against me. So there was no reason for me to.
Was the order responsive? In other words, that you don't have to name one unless they do?
Well, I was making a decision as an attorney for OSCO saying I'm not going to name an expert if they haven't named one against me.
Okay, but the order didn't say you only name it if they've named one against you.
No.
Okay.
Well, I just made a strategic decision in that sense.
Thank you.
So I filed my decision in December of my motion in December of 03. Our hearing on this is not till February 17th, 2.5 months later. That means from September 12, at the very latest, when Galbraith was deposed, up until February 17th, when we had our hearing, that Galbraith knew plaintiffs didn't have an expert against us, that their own client had admitted liability, and they get to the summary judgment motion hearing, and do they say, you know what, we need some additional time to get an expert against OSCO, which they could have done. No. Do they say, I've got an affidavit here from an expert and a report from an expert, and we're going to go after OSCO here? No. What do they say? They say, I can sit on my hands and wait and figure out what I'm going to do. And actually, they were not timely, even after we were granted summary judgment. 8 months later is when they filed the third-party complaint. So if we're looking at fundamental fairness in this whole thing, and we're looking at context, I don't know how you can say that the context of Judge Gempler's order, after you read Fiorenza saying, I am not going to decide these other issues, and you read what they requested of the order, I don't know how they could say our rights were preserved.
But could I ask
Justice Prosser?
The March 8, 2004 order, who drafted that?
There were two orders that were drafted. One was submitted by myself, and one was submitted by counsel for Galbraith. And I believe that the one that he signed was the one that was submitted by Galbraith.
Well, the one...
There was a dispute about that.
February 25th by Mr. Sager.
Well, he'd be counsel for Galbraith.
Is different from the one that was signed on March 8th.
You know what? I don't have that in front of me, to be honest with you. I assumed it was that order. It may have been that Gempler drew up his own order. To be honest with you, I didn't see that difference. He did not sign the order that I submitted. I admit that.
But the language that this order is in no way intended to affect the rights of other parties, etc., that is lifted, I believe, word for word from the order that was submitted by Mr. Sager.
That could be. And my point on that is that particular phrase was, I believe, very intentionally ambiguous as submitted by Mr. Sager, because if you see the transcript of Fiorenza's decision, when they're arguing, you have to specifically reserve it out. You have to specifically say it doesn't affect Galbraith. We want this without prejudice. And Judge Fiorenza says, I'm not going to decide any of those issues now. I'm giving this on the merits, and we'll raise that when it comes up. that context. And then you see Gempler, when he is the one who signs the order, and we go in for summary judgment on the third-party complaint, and Gempler says, you're entitled to summary judgment. I wasn't carving anything out here. You've got the bookends on both sides. I don't know how the context can be, oh, they were reserving it. Who was reserving it?
Well, it seems to me what you're saying that Judge Fiorenzo said during a hearing and what appears in the written order, that there's a little difference between those two, or maybe not.
I don't see that as a difference. I think, in fact, counsel admitted in his oral argument on the questioning from Justice Butler, he said it could be read in just the context that I am stating, that all is being said in this order is we'll deal with those other issues later. I believe that was a paraphrase of Justice Butler's question, and counsel admitted, yes, it could be. And he said, look at the context, and I'm giving you a larger context than he is with the bookends of Fiorenza's decision and then Gempler saying, I didn't carve out anything.
Isn't the context here, I mean, I'm just, as a former trial judge, I'm thinking about what goes on in trial court. Isn't the context here that you have a reserve judge who's sitting in to handle a portion of the case, and you have the permanent judge who comes in and makes the ultimate ruling? And the reserve judge is asked to do certain things and says, not today. Isn't that the context?
I think that is part of the context, but I also think he's accurate. Because the only thing that was before him when I brought my summary judgment motion was, am I entitled to summary judgment on the merits, which he decided I was. The whole issue of what happens if they try and bring me back in later, which we discussed on the record, but what happens if they try and bring me back in, what's the implication of precision erecting, which we brought up, really is kind of a movie preview. It's a preview of what may happen down the road. It has nothing to do with the decision Fiorenza made on that date. The order then gets signed, and when we get to the next movie, pardon me taking this analogy a little too far, is when Gempler then rules on summary judgment in our favor, saying, I never carved out anything here. And he goes back and says, precision erecting is on all fours here. If you're looking at fairness, we did everything by the book here. We filed our motion on the date by which we were supposed to file our motion. We argued our summary judgment motion. We were granted summary judgment. And now what they're trying to do is bring us back in when they could have contested that at any time. And what you in effect may end up with if you allow them to bring us back in is allow them to pursue OSCO on a claim for negligence in cause when the trial court has already ruled that the plaintiffs can't.
Mr. Cott, if I could, just so that I'm clear on your argument, from your perspective, just what should Dr. Galbraith have done differently to preserve the issues in this case?
Any number of things, but I'll give you a few examples, part of which I said already. Number one, as of September 12th of 03, when his own when the doctor herself testified and she said, I'm at fault, I filled it out wrong, and with the plaintiffs already having not named an expert against me, at that time, if I'm them and I want to get a case against OSCO, I'm looking for an expert. When I know I have a deadline for naming experts coming up in about 6 weeks. Okay, maybe they can't. Then when I file my summary judgment motion on December 1st, and they see OSCO is now moving for summary judgment because there's no experts, I move for an extension of time with the trial judge and say, you know what, I need extra time to get an expert about OSCO or at least to think about it. That wasn't done. 2.5 months later, when we go to the hearing, I would have said, if I was them, I would have said, you know, I think that we may have a case against OSCO. Judge, can we defer or move this summary judgment motion hearing back 2 months to give me more time? Of course, I would have, pardon the expression, screamed bloody murder about that because it would have been a long time already. But they could have done it that. They didn't do any of those things. What they did was they said at that hearing, I can sit on my hands and see what happens. And the case law from Precision to the Reese case before that says that's exactly what you can't do. And I would believe it would be a shame to carve out an exception in this case if you're going to give more instruction on what to do. But to carve out an exception in this case when the parties here basically said we're going to sit on it and see what happens.
But this,
Would you have been able to get summary judgment against the plaintiff here if they had named an expert early on?
Well, it depends what that expert testified to, obviously. If the expert was named and I was fortunate enough to do a good job at the deposition and somehow they admitted Oscar didn't do anything wrong, then I could. But if they created a question of fact, I couldn't.
If the plaintiff didn't name any expert, the plaintiff could rely on their expert? Is that?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. I thought your question was if the plaintiff named an expert in the original action, would I be able to?
I'm sorry. Dr. Galbraith had named an expert, could you have been able to dismiss, or not dismiss, get a summary judgment against the plaintiff?
Not if Dr. Galbraith, possibly. But frankly, if there's an expert in the case who's testifying that my client failed to exercise a proper standard of care and was causal of the damages, and the complaint of the plaintiff was still pending against me, I don't think I could go in unless they stipulated somehow to a dismissal against me. There's an expert in the case, but I don't know that for sure.
If it just seems to me, not being a trial lawyer, but it seems to me sort of tactically undesirable for the two defendants to be in an evidentiary trial, just tearing at each other, saying, you're negligent, no, you're negligent, and the plaintiff sitting back and taking it all in and rubbing the state's hand.
You know, I agree that tactically that may inure to the benefit of the plaintiff, but the fact is I can't, when I look at a case, say, sometimes I might say, you know, it doesn't pay to, in the vernacular, dump on each other. I mean, that's what we say.
Don't tell us everything.
Well, legal term.
But I'm not saying, but in this particular case, when I've got a doctor who's admitted that they wrote the wrong prescription and they're going to try to blame the pharmacist that filled it, it's kind of like save me from myself defense. I am certainly going to get an expert that is critical of the doctor. So it depends on each case. And I think the argument, they've tried to use that argument several times, well, we don't do this in medical malpractice cases. Well, you know what? We make strategy decisions all the time, and you live with the consequences of them, and they're not, the strategy is not in a statute that's protected. There are consequences, and the consequence in this particular case was they didn't object to the summary judgment motion. There is no exception for that under existing Wisconsin law, and that's why we were entitled to summary judgment on our motion.
Well, this is why I raised the question whether it was really a summary judgment or it was a voluntary dismissal for having failed to bring in an expert, or as Justice Bradley suggests, that it was really a sanction in disguise. And the only reason that may be important is it goes to the first issue of whether the issue was litigated.
Well, Justice Abramson, all I can say is this. It puts a pretty tough standard on a defense attorney or defendant if you can't rely on the rules of burden of proof and go in on a summary judgment motion and just say, well, you know, that's a technicality. I'm not saying that's what you're saying, but that's
summary judgment is that there's no dispute in fact.
Right.
And you're saying because the plaintiff couldn't show you were negligent or show any of your conduct under an expert witness, there is no dispute of fact. They agree with you, a denial. That's your position.
Yeah.
Summaries. Summarized.
Yeah. And the plaintiff's firm and the plaintiff's attorneys here are highly accomplished attorneys who will have no trouble getting experts when they want to get experts against clients of mine in other cases. So I can tell you when I went back to my client after this was all done and I said, we got summary judgment, I was calling it a victory and was thrilled to get it. It wasn't a situation where they agreed to sign a stipend order for dismissal. I would have done that if they would have done it. But in this case, I moved for summary judgment and I got it.
Okay, counsel, thank you. Mr. Eckstein gets 8 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Brett Eckstein, and I do represent the Reillys in this matter. There's kind of a theme running through here that I want to pick up on right away, and that is the plaintiffs did not drop the ball in this case. This is a case about a resident physician who admitted that she wrote a wrong prescription, contrary to the direct orders of her attending physician to write a prescription for a weekly dosage. She wrote it for a daily dosage. Osco took that prescription. Osco filled it as written. And the prescription that Osco filled is not facially excessive, that there are certain conditions that a daily dosage of this drug is permissible. Frank Reilly took that prescription. He was seriously injured. He became gravely ill, which required a month's stay in a hospital and another month of care in a nursing home after that. Now, the plaintiffs in this case sued the resident doctor, Dr. Galbraith, the attending physician, Dr. Russell, and Osco for what we believed at that time were their respective roles in causing the Reilly's damages. As discovery commenced, we learned the following. Number one, that Dr. Russell had absolutely no notice of the wrong prescription until Frank Reilly was in the hospital with a chemical overdose. Number two, we learned that Osco filled the prescription as written and that the prescription is not facially excessive. But more importantly, we learned that Dr. Galbraith herself admitted that she made a mistake, that Osco filled the prescription as written, and that prescription errors are never really acceptable. Based on this, and based on the controlling law at the time, when Dr. Russell and Osco moved for summary judgment, we did not oppose. We knew, based on precision erecting and based on Geis, this Court's decision in Geis, and the Court of Appeals' concomitant similar decision in Hayes, that if no one stepped up and opposed the summary judgment motion, Osco and Dr. Russell, they would be out as a matter of law, that the summary judgment would operate to exonerate them of liability as a matter of law, and that if anyone disagreed with our assessment that these two entities did not share culpability here, they had a duty, they had an obligation to come forward and do one of two things. Number one, present a genuine issue of material fact to create an issue for trial. If they could not do that, then they had to, number two, request a continuance, which the summary judgment statute specifically allows, so that they could go out there and do their discovery to create a genuine issue of material fact. They did neither. This is not a default case. This is a summary judgment case. This is not a motion to dismiss case. This is not a motion for failure to prosecute. This is summary judgment. We've already heard that the courts have described summary judgment as being self-evident, that it is self-evident that it alleges that certain facts are undisputed, number one, and that, number two, the party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. What Osco's
Well, how can it be self-evident that material facts are undisputed when you have the doctor pursuing the position that, hey, we want to preserve our contribution claim here, we want to preserve our contribution claim here, which is self-evident that that has to be based on Osco doing something wrong. So it's as though they are asserting it, but the degree of assertion maybe is the problem. I mean, they asserted it, it seems to me, all along, that we want to preserve our claim.
There is one way to oppose a summary judgment motion, and that is to proffer from a person with personal knowledge who has evidentiary facts that can create a genuine issue of material fact. That's it.
Why is that the only way? Why can't you say, Judge, I'd like just an equitable relief here. And the just and equitable relief with regard to the motion for summary judgment is just consistent with the terms that the court ultimately signed, if I can find it under the stack here, essentially saying we're going to leave it open. It's, you know, I'm using a little shorthand. I mean,
sure.
Why isn't that a viable option? The court in his discretion.
The summary judgment methodology is so well known to the appellate court system that they often kind of default around it in all of their opinions, that they say, look, we've been dealing with it before, and we're not going to talk about it now because everyone knows what it is. But if you go back to that summary judgment methodology, it outlines exactly what a litigant's duty is when faced with a motion for summary judgment.
Mm-hmm. And the linchpin of it is there's no genuine issue of material fact, but isn't the doctor putting the court on notice, Judge, there may be an issue of material fact, and we want to preserve our right to pursue that?
If you go back and look at the transcript, what OSCO did is it took the position of, we may have a right of contribution here. You know, it's in our prayer for relief and our answer 12 months ago. But look, we may or may not have a claim. I haven't determined whether I want to make a claim. So I'm entitled to kind of sit back and wait and see, if you will, to see what the plaintiff decides to do. This isn't a case where they were trying to reserve their rights. They hadn't made a decision yet. They should have made a decision by now, but for whatever reason, they didn't. With the understanding that even if they wanted to preserve it, then they should have requested a continuance. They should have given an affidavit saying, Judge, we need more time. You cannot, however, submit an affidavit, which is what they do, that essentially reads, Judge, look, we don't oppose the motion, all right? But that motion, if you're going to grant judgment, that judgment should be binding on this party only, but not as to us. Precision Erecting makes clear that there is no such judgment. There is no animal in the law where a court can adjudicate the facts one way with respect to one party and another way to a different party. A judgment is a determination of the action, and that has to retain meaning. I mean, if that doesn't retain meaning, think of the consequences. There are two significant consequences, and I'll deal with the more flippant one first, and that's what we have here is the hokey-pokey of litigation. You know, litigants, they begin, they bring parties in, and then they sit back and wait, and they see how things kind of go, and then courts take parties out by way of judgment, and then, notwithstanding the judgment, that litigant brings the party back in and shakes them all about for responsibility. Well,
and then you turn around, and now you're with it.
and that's best reserved for weddings and bar mitzvahs. The point is that has no place in litigation. In litigation, you bring your claims all in one case. All right, if Galbraith was serious, and if she really wanted to pursue a contribution claim, she should have been preserving that right from day one.
Yeah, except that the statute says you don't have to bring it all in one claim.
And that's where we disagree. The statute says you have 1 year to bring a claim.
Right.
But the claim of contribution is contingent on, one, being joint tortfeasors, two, having common liability, and three, paying more than your fair share. If one party gets out on summary judgment, that party is exonerated as a matter of law. There is no joint tortfeasor anymore. There is no common liability. The only issue that's remaining in that case is Dr. Galbraith's responsibility to us. That's it.
That's interesting, because in an auto accident case, if somebody gets out on a release, when you go to the final verdict, everybody gets clipped. I mean, that is, the jury is told about everybody. So I'm not sure you're right. I'm not sure you're wrong. Pardon me?
And I respectfully disagree, Chief, and that's
okay,
because the
Hayes
decision.
Okay, that's right. Do you have a cite?
Yes, I do. And that's the Hayes decision, which is cited in our brief and which is relied on, which is 140 with second, 187. And that case specifically says that the general rule is yes. Any potential responsibilities go on the special verdict if there's evidence to support that they were responsible. Hayes dealt with this exact situation where a party, one of the two defendants, got summary judgment and was then dismissed from the case. The co-defendant then was crying foul at the special verdict conference saying, but I want to include the defendant on the verdict. They're responsible. The Court of Appeals there categorically and very clearly said, in no circumstances when a party is given summary judgment can they be included on the special verdict. By operation of law, by summary judgment, that party is exonerated as a matter of law, and that party does not go on the verdict.
Counselor, I know your red light is on, but I have a question I want to ask you, and I'm going to ask opposing counsel when he comes back up because I forgot about it. There was a claim for contribution and indemnification, and we've talked always about contribution, which requires a joint tortfeasor. Indemnification, in my experience, usually is a contractual right, and no one's talked anything about it, and I just want to give you a chance to say, is there any basis for an indemnification claim?
And I think the Court of Appeals in Precision Erecting, and if it wasn't Precision Erecting, then it's certainly Geis, held that the exact same analysis applies. Indemnification, contribution, no matter what you call it, some way of allocating responsibility between the defendants is determinative.
You could have a contractual right of indemnification, which has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not OSCO is negligent or causal of an injury to Rillis. So I'm really focusing, do you know of anything that you want to comment about that? I understand your arguments in regard to joint tort-feasors.
You know, I don't know if there is any issue as to sort of an agreement between OSCO and Galbraith or the medical college whereby they agree to kind of hold each other harmless in some respects.
Okay.
But if they do have a contract action out there that's somehow contingent on the liability here, I think my answer would still be the same because the liability portion of that is determined in this action.
Thank you.
So you disagree with the Waddell's brief that you as plaintiff could get hurt here by having a verdict in part against OSCO?
Today is the first time that I've heard that Galbraith has no interest in pursuing OSCO in my case, mostly because, and I expressed surprise at that when I heard that, because they filed a third-party complaint. And if you look at... If you look in their appendix at 139, they filed a third-party complaint in my action with my caption. Again, and pulling
a little possessive, counsel.
Sorry, that's okay.
Go drug.
I'll give it back.
But they now want to take the position that their contribution rights will be litigated in a separate action. I'm sure OSCO Drug would have a great deal to say about that. But as long as the plaintiff is not harmed, we have no quarrel with
but
that.
But that's what I'm really been asking you. You say they won't be because in your action, they can't be, jury would not be asked to allocate.
If Galbraith is stipulating before the highest court in this state that it will not put OSCO on the verdict, it will not impute negligence to OSCO during our case, again, I'm sure OSCO would have a great deal to say about that, but from the plaintiff's point of view, we would not be harmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Van Sicklen.
I'm going to kind of work backwards on a few of the questions. Justice Rogensack's question. I've always understood the difference between indemnification and contribution to be the difference between tort claims and more of a contractual claim. The Seventh Circuit had a case last year that talked about the economic loss doctrine.
Right. And that's my understanding, too, but I never asked you about it. And so I thought, well, I wanted to, and I would ask opposing counsel because they aren't going to get back up here. So is there anything to do with an indemnification claim that we ought to be thinking about?
I don't think for purposes of today it's different. I guess I agree with the last counsel that the analysis is the same in that regard. There's no contract.
Okay, there's no contract. Okay.
Right. All right. This is purely a tort. And then also in response to the last counsel's comment, we've never taken the position that if this court remands that it doesn't have the right to structure how we try our contribution claim. Either way, our conclusion in our reply brief is very clear that it's you could do it either way. Then I'd like to talk about, again, both counsel avoid talking about 80208 sub 4. The last lawyer talks about there's only one way of opposing summary judgment. Well, sub 4 talks about three choices for the trial judge. One, when confronting with a situation like we brought here. One is they can give a continuance or they can deny the request of Dr. Galbraith, or they can enter another order, which is what happened here. And if the order means what Mr. Katz says, there's no reason he would have written the letter that he did to Judge Gempfler that's in our appendix at page A132. And Justice Prosser asked about the difference between the two orders. I think when you look in our appendix, Justice, at A126 to 35, the whole chronology is laid out there with either the judges or the clerks indexed to them. I believe the two orders, the one that my predecessor counsel, submitted to Judge Gempfler, is the same as the one that got signed. The formatting is a little different, but the language appears to be identical. And I think the language there is important because
It preserved the right to bring a claim as allowed by statute, and the statute, of course, is the one that Justice Rogensack, you know, pointed to. It's 893.92, the right to bring a contribution claim. It dovetails and is exactly what Dr. Galbraith had talked about throughout. Mr. Catt kept mentioning that Dr. Galbraith admitted liability, but I guess we respectfully don't think it's quite that simple. He didn't bring a motion for summary judgment saying that we were liable as a matter of law. And, in fact, we put in evidence at the summary judgment proceeding the testimony of Dr. Galbraith showing the basis for bringing a contribution claim back against OSCO, talking about the pharmacist can and should raise questions if something appears to be amiss in the prescription.
Mr. Van Sicklen, if I could, let me ask you about 80208 sub 3 regarding summary judgment. When a motion for summary judgment is made and support is provided in this section, an adverse party may not rest upon the mere allegations or denials of the pleadings, but the adverse party's response by affidavits or as otherwise provided in this section must set forth specific facts showing that there is a genuine issue for trial. If the adverse party does not so respond, summary judgment, if appropriate, shall be entered against the party. Is it enough under this section to say, hey, we want to preserve these rights, or do you have to do something more specific as the statute provides?
I think that's exactly what sub 4 goes on to say. There's plenty of situations where a party says, we're not ready, it's not fair in the context here to require us to come forth, that we should be allowed one of these other options, go out and take a continuance or preserve our claim. And that's what happened here.
Which gets me back to my first question. Under sub 4, isn't that discretionary? And didn't the trial court exercise discretion here?
I don't believe so. I think it's de novo under this court's prior precedent, as you and I talked about a little earlier. And there was no application of the 5 criteria here. Clearly, whether or not we should have appealed the entry of that summary judgment order, that's a de novo inquiry, and you've said that in these other cases. And I also think these other criteria are legal questions. And the judge here never made any kind of analysis and applied those 5 factors in a way that you can review whether he was right or wrong. There's also this, I think Mr. Catt said that somehow we weren't timely in bringing our contribution claim. We brought it timely under the amended scheduling order. It was completely timely. And Justice Prosser, I think, does make a very good point on this tactical question. That's why we believe it's a bad idea to convert contingent contribution claims into mandatory cross-claims where you're forcing defendants in these multi-party cases to prove the plaintiff's case. It becomes, I don't think, consistent with judicial efficiency and economy to do it that way. I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen, for your arguments, and Mr. Eckstein and Mr. Catt for another argument relating to the obligations of a party on summary judgment relating to contribution. That concludes our hearing on 058B1407. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. The court will be in conference at 3:15.